So Job chapter 19 is what we'll plan to cover this week. Good to see those of you who are here. Looks like we're missing quite a few, but hope everybody's doing okay. I figure probably some people working out some travel plans perhaps as well. So just to recap from the past couple of chapters that we've looked at, in chapter 17, which is where we finished talking last Sunday, I think we made it through verse 5, we have Job concluding his response to Eliphaz's second statement to him. And in that section from Job chapter 16, verse 18 through 17:5, we have Job expressing his desire for these events to be remembered so that he might be vindicated by God from the false accusations of his friends. And that's significant because this idea of accountability and this idea of vindication, we're going to be looking at more of that in chapter 19, because Job definitely gets into that more in chapter 19. The rest of chapter 17 and 18 was included in the write-up that I sent out. But to summarize, Job finishes chapter 17 by expressing his hopelessness. And we see him again thinking of the inevitability of Sheol. If you look at chapter 17 and verses 13 through 16, Job says, "If I hope for Sheol as my house, if I make my bed in darkness, if I say to the pit, 'You are my father,' and to the worm, 'My mother,' or 'My sister,' where then is my hope? Who will see my hope? Will it go down to the bars of Sheol? Shall we descend into the together into the dust?" So this kind of in response to Eliphaz trying to give him this message of hope that, hey, you know, the lightness is right near the darkness is kind of what Eliphaz was telling him. And Job is saying, well, I'm basically out of time. So, I mean, what of this hope that you speak? Is that going to go down to Sheol with me? Are we going to go down there together? And if so, who's going to see it then? Am I going to see it? Are you going to see it? So, again, just this expressions of hopelessness, I think, is the idea. So then in chapter 18, you have Bildad replying to this. And Bildad right away seems indignant over Job's freshest insults directed at him and his friends. And in verse 4, he says, "You who tear yourself in anger, shall the earth be forsaken for you, or the rock be removed out of his place?" And I think the idea being presented there is like, to me, I picture this toddler, and I mentioned this in the write-up, like this toddler who things just aren't going their way, and he's just screaming and raging and thrashing and all these things, and what good is that really going to do? It's not going to affect anything. You know, it's certainly, in Job's case, all of his thrashing and irrational anger, is that really going to change things? So what good is it, I think, is the point that Bildad is trying to show to Job. And then Bildad, throughout the rest of the chapter, he uses a mix of symbolism and also straight talk to try to make the point that what's happening to Job is Job's fault. In fact, it's not someone else's fault. He talks about how Job's own feet have brought him here, and he keeps going to his feet, that you're walking this way. You know, the idea being like no one's pulling you against your will, but you're in control of your own feet here. So you've started walking down this road, but you didn't realize in walking down this road that there's all these traps laid for you, and you're just stumbling over them like a blind person is stumbling over them. So this idea that Job is being accused now of being stubborn and just plowing ahead without regard to the consequences of his actions. He's making these decisions about how he's going to live and what he's going to say, and it's not working out for him. So then Bildad closes in chapter 18 by cursing of sorts, cursing the endurance of the life that Job has chosen to live. According to Bildad, the dwelling place of the unrighteous is like a tent. He uses that image a couple of times. The thought of a tent being something that's temporary by its nature. It's not a permanent dwelling place. It's what you would use if you're moving from place to place. So it's temporary. And in verse 17, he plainly tells him that this wicked man, his memory perishes from the earth, and he has no name in the street. So again, no permanence, no memory of the person who decides to keep going down the path that Job is going. And if you remember this theme of endurance or lacking endurance, that was also kind of a very prevalent theme in Bildad's first response as well. A lot of the images he uses back in chapter 8 have to do with the fleeting nature of one who's not grounded in God. And he uses those images of like these lotus plants, I think it was, that bloom for really quickly, but they don't have water and they fade quickly, and these other images that he uses. So he keeps coming back to kind of that same point. So that's a real quick summary of chapter 17 and 18. Were there any comments or questions about any of that before we get into chapter 19? Okay. So let's turn our attention to chapter 19. And just some of the things I was thinking about as I was reading chapter 19 is how this chapter, and really you could say the whole book of Job, it's such a case study in relationships. How we internalize things, how we express our frustrations towards others. I think there's a lot for us to see here and to consider when we have these types of problems. I mean, it's not probably going to be as severe as what Job was facing, but I think there's a lot to benefit from when we look at these things. So we'll start in verses 1 through 4. So starting in verse 1, then Job answered and said, "How long will you torment me and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you have cast reproach upon me. Are you not ashamed to wrong me? And even if it be true that I have erred, my error remains with myself." So it's kind of funny. Maybe funny is not the right word. But in the first couple of verses, when he says, "How long will you torment me and break me in pieces with these words?" I think you're getting a sense for how testy Job is becoming with Bildad. And he's almost deliberately mocking Bildad and saying it like this. Because if you go back to chapter 8, let's look at Bildad's rebukes of Job. Bildad chapter 8, Job chapter 8, Bildad speaking. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, "How long will you say these things and the words of your mouth be a great wind?" And then jump over again to chapter 18, verses 1 and 2. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, "How long will you hunt for words?" And now you have Job saying, "How long will you torment me and break me in pieces with your words?" So this theme, this statement that Bildad seems to like to use to start his argument, "How long will you blah? How long will you blah?" Job's saying, "How long will you?" So he's kind of turning it back around on him. And it's, I think, a demonstration of how irritated he's getting with this annoying little phrase that Bildad seems to be latching onto before he starts his rebuke. And again, funny is probably not the right word, but it is kind of amusing that when you go to chapter 25, Bildad doesn't use it again. So it's kind of funny. So we're going to kind of look at verse 4 and back up a little bit over this, because there's a lot we can pull from this. But looking at verse 4, when Job says, "And even if it be true that I have erred, my error remains with myself." So I think what Job is saying here is that he is in fact prepared to bear the consequences of his error. I think that's what that means. And that would be very unlike this man that Bildad was talking about in chapter 18, who's wandering blindly down this path, not considering the consequences of his actions. So he's saying, "No, I'm not like that guy. I'm ready. I can bear the consequences of my errors." And maybe he's saying that because first and foremost, the way he sees it, he's not erred to begin with, right? I mean, he's prepared to take accountability for his actions, but at the end of the day, he's not done anything wrong. He's innocent in his own eyes. So now backing up to verse 3, when he says, "These 10 times you have cast reproach on me, are you not ashamed to wrong me?" I think this verse really introduces the main topic of this chapter. Job is trying to get Bildad to recognize that he himself is the one who's not considering the consequences of his actions. So Bildad has just accused him of being this wicked man, walking down this path, not considering where you're going, like a blind man stumbling into trap after trap. But Job's about to really go into Bildad and his three friends, "Are you not ashamed to wrong me?" And he's going to talk about aren't you worried about this judgment that might come on you for the things that you're saying right now? Because God will judge you for that. So in typical Job fashion, he's taking his friend's arguments and he's using it against them. They're giving him material. He's subverting it and then sending it back at them, which is something he does pretty commonly. So then backing up to verse 2, again, he says, how long will you torment me and break me into pieces with words? We talked about this a couple of times already. We consider how much Job has been suffering, but we see the power of words, right? He talks about, how long will you break me into pieces with words? It was really troubling to Job what was being said to him by his friends. And in light of all the other suffering he was going through, this was really at the forefront of what was troubling him and what he's addressing in his speech. It really bothers him that these words are being spoken against him. And if you remember back in chapter 16, Job put himself in their place and said, if I were in your position, I could either build you up or tear you down. Right? So why are you choosing to tear me down is the implication. So it isn't enough for them, the way Job sees it, that he's suffering physically and certainly emotionally. I mean, he's lost his children. He's lost lots of other things. But he wants them to just leave him alone, in a sense. Like, either comfort me or just stop talking. Just leave me alone. And it's interesting, too. Let's skip down for a moment and look at verse 22. And we'll get to the rest of these passages in just a moment, but I want to try to tie these ideas together. In Job chapter 19 and verse 22, Job says, why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh? So it's just interesting now that in light of this rebuke that he's about to give his friends, or he's in process of giving to his friends, and in light of the judgment he's warning them of, he's equating what they're doing to what God is doing to him, which is really interesting. He's saying basically, in this way, in your pursuit of me, in your relentless focus on where I've done wrong, you're like God in this, and I don't want this. So this kind of opens the door to a little bit of interesting analysis on what Job thinks of God at this point. Again, he's calling his friends out that they're going to be judged by God. And for what? For doing kind of the same thing that God's doing to him. And if you remember, I know this is like lots of chapters back, but I did a write-up for chapter 15. And one of the things I noted in that write-up is Job requesting an audience with God when he does that doesn't seem to me like it would serve a purpose of relating any new information to God. In other words, if Job couldn't convince God to relent through prayer and through demonstrations of humility like he was doing, then what new thing is he going to be able to present to God if he were to be there face to face with him? So we tried to consider then what's really behind that request. What is Job really wanting? Because it's not like he doesn't have access to be able to petition God, beg of God, explain to God anything that's on his mind. He can through prayer. So what I think Job's angling for is this idea that if God could see him face to face and be confronted with the question of why are you doing this to me, that God might see Job and think that I'm persecuting an innocent man. I think that's what Job, in his mind, was thinking of here. And you get shades of that as we go through all these chapters. And I think you're seeing some of it here in that Job, I think, wants God to explain himself. Job wants God to give him an answer. Like, why is this happening to me? And I think that he knows all the while that God doesn't owe him an explanation. And I think he knows that he may never get one. In fact, I think his hopelessness would suggest he doesn't think he's going to get one, even though he's asking for this opportunity. And I think maybe you're starting to see him project some of that frustration of not being able to hold God accountable onto his friends by saying, you're going to be accountable. And by the way, you're doing the same things that God's doing. So he's, I think, projecting some of that towards his friends. He's not going to be able to call God into judgment, but he can warn his friends that judgment's coming. And while he's doing that, he's equating their persecution of him to what God's doing to them. Yeah, Billy? Yes. Well, such great points, and really that hits to the biggest picture application I want us to take from this. And that's why I see one of the benefits of looking at this kind of verse by verse like we're doing, which isn't, I'll admit, a common approach to the book of Job, but it's to try to make it real, and it's to try to show there's a lot of application here for us in very practical ways. It demonstrates how we succeed and fail in dealing with difficulties and with each other, even with our close friends and family. And like you said, the nuances are there, and I can relate to them. I can relate to the idea of being upset or frustrated in one aspect of my life and projecting that in other ways and onto other people, you know, and that type of thing. It's fascinating to think, too, that, again, this is a poem, right? I mean, this is a high-level art form that people who really know what they're talking about when they look at ancient literature look at this as, like, this is one of the greatest literary works of all time, like, as a poem, and the way it's structured and the subtlety of the elements that the poet is working into this, that some of it's lost on us because we don't, we're just not as smart as some other people are, and we aren't as close to the context as when it was written, and it's been translated several times. But even throughout all that, you still have someone who's maintaining these nuances in a poem, which is really difficult than like writing a prose or a narrative about something where you can really focus on what's going on internally. But to draw this out while maintaining a poetic structure and then having it survive several translations, and we're still getting this. It's just, I agree with you. I mean, it's a faith-building thing for me, and I'm just really impressed by it. I love the book of Job for all those reasons. It's just really, really impressive. Thank you for your comments. So this desire that Job has for an explanation, this will become more and more of a focus, I think, as we move towards the end of the book. But I want to spend just a little bit of time setting some thoughts there. On this desire for an explanation. And I want to ask, you know, if things haven't been going well for us, and we want to know why, asking why or getting an answer to why, is that really, really what we want? To know why something happened? I think that when you're going through it, it's like right up there at the top. You want to know why this is happening. And I think that if you think you understand why and you can make sense of it, there's some level of comfort or reassurance in knowing there's a reason. But I don't want us to lose sight of the actual goal and why we would ask why. Because the actual goal is to be at peace with this. The actual goal is to be comforted. And asking why is a way in our minds we think we can get to that place. We think if we can understand why this is happening, then we can be okay with it because we're really unsettled about it right now. And we want to not be unsettled. We want to be comforted. We want to have peace. And I think that when you get to God's response at the end of the book, that's what it's all about. It's about giving comfort and giving peace, even if you don't know why. Even if you don't get an answer to that question, God bypasses the question and goes right to really what you want and what you need. Yeah, John?
And to add to that, my own experiences have been, I think a lot of it is an attempt to retain some sense of power, knowledge, power, that thing. When you can understand something, when you can wrap your mind around something, you can understand why something's happening, you feel like you have a bit more control over things. Challenge is, you trust me.
Yeah. And why do we want control? Why is that an important thing for us? Because you're right. You're right. We want to know why so we can have some power to affect the situation. But why is that important to us? I mean, I would argue it's really coming back to the same thing, right? We're unsettled right now. And we think if we can control the flow of events or have some power or some say in what's going on, then we can be comforted in that. We can have more peace in that. Because if it's not in our hands and it's in someone else's hands, and if we don't trust that other person, then where does that leave me? I'm kind of unsettled in that. So again, I think at the core, we're seeking to have peace with this situation. And I think that that's what God brings to Job. And I would just encourage you, if you have time, this is okay to keep jumping ahead to the end. Like, go jump ahead to the end and read through it. And read through the end in the context of the passages and the verses that we're talking about as we go, as we're working through this discourse between Job and his friends. And see how it fits as more and more stuff is revealed throughout this conversation. But what you're going to see is that God does give Job comfort. And he vindicates him in front of his friends. Right? He gives him that vindication because he calls out the error of his friends in front of Job. So Job gets those things that are going to bring him comfort, but he doesn't get just a complete answer to his question. He certainly doesn't get to play out this little fantasy he has in his mind of being in front of God and putting God on trial. So anyway, interesting too, we talk about the layers going on here. It's not that Job didn't even recognize this to some degree. He knows that what he really wants is peace. And that's what he's asking of his friends, right? He just give me some comfort. Right? That's what he's asking his friends to do. So there's a lot of levels to work through here. He wants his friends to comfort him, not fix him. He's decided he would like for God to explain why, but again, really, he needs this comfort. So he obviously needs it, and he's aware of it to some degree. And again, I have to look at this. It's like, look, this is a really, really good guy who's really struggling through some things right now. And in some ways, he's a little all over the map, but you can also see how humble he is, even though he's a little all over the map in what he's asking for. His humility is still there. His intelligence is still there. Like, man, I would not want to be on the other side of a debate with Job, especially if he's decided he's not going to restrain his lips, right? Because he feels vindicated in saying these things. He's really, really smart, really, really brilliant in how he turns his opponent's arguments around on them. So those are some of the big picture things I want to make sure we had a chance to get through. And a lot of the rest of chapter 19, I think, is just going to support those themes. So we'll get in touch in a second. Yeah, John? It's okay, man. Keep drifting. No, that's fine, man. Yeah, chew on it some more. And I mean, I think that you know, a lot of things you're talking about are things that you know, appeal to me too. You know, this book has a way of as deep as it is in some places and difficult to understand, and as philosophical as it can be, because it operates a lot on a philosophical level. It's a lot of the real basic things that I find myself thinking about, and I may have even written this up. I'm starting to lose track of what I've written and what I haven't, so I apologize. But, you know, ideas of, you know, the frailty of life and my relationship with God and my relationship with others, and, you know, the certainty of death, and what are we doing about that? You know, is that a topic we just avoid because it's uncomfortable or it's inconvenient, you know, to what's going on? But there's so much I can take from it. So absolutely, brother. You know, finish your. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, there are a lot of approaches on how to deal with suffering, and perhaps maybe this is what I'm trying to get at. This is the right way to suffer. There are a lot, and I've heard this from the pulpit. You need to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and get back to work. And I think there's righteous man, a blameless man, who is suffering, and he doesn't just pull himself up by his own bootstraps. He allows himself to just sit in it and to just feel all the feels. And that's, in my own experience, in my own walk, I've seen where I've tried to do that first approach of pulling myself up by my own bootstraps and doing it myself. And it just suck you back down. And then these questions keep popping back up, and you can try to repress them all you want. You try to, they just keep popping up, and they keep popping up. And until you sit down and you just deal with it, and you just feel it, and you just embrace it, that's when you can have this sense of closure, this sense of, okay, we can move on now.
That's really interesting that you bring that up, because I had actually written some notes about that, and I kind of scaled them back because I didn't know how much to want to force that on you. But I thought of the same things going through this chapter specifically. I thought about how I don't know if I'm ready to say it's a culture issue or you know, the way that we've been raised. Or just the way, sometimes, like in the church, we have these tendencies to do things a certain way. But maybe it's not just about us in our context, but this idea that, let's just move on. You need to just move on.
Well, I think it's evident in the way we approach the book of Jonah.
That's right. Just tell me what God says, and I think that's a really good point. And I think that in a way, I'm kind of forcing you guys to sit in it with Job, right? I mean, you don't have to be here, so I'm not really forcing you. But if you want to be in our Bible class, then I'm kind of forcing you to sit in it with Job a little bit, because I think you're right. I think we need to understand, how does the Bible present a person dealing with real problems? And how are they doing well in that? How are they not doing so well in that? What things could have happened differently? I mean, there's so much to look at here. You know, it's not a template of perfection from Job's sense, but in another sense, it really is. It's like, this is everything that God thinks we need to see and know about how to handle yourself in this situation and what you can learn from it. So I think those are really, really good points. Really, and appreciate your thoughts on that. So we've got about 7 minutes left. Let's see if we can get through most of the rest of the chapter. And again, I've made most of the points that I think I wanted to make. verses 5 and 6, chapter 19. Job continues, "If indeed you magnify yourselves against me and make my disgrace an argument against me, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me." So Job is here accusing them of magnifying themselves against him, meaning I think that they're feeling justified in their own righteousness based on how they see God punishing this wicked person, and that's not happening to them. So Job's accusing them of being like, hey, you're building yourself up at my expense. And this idea of when Job says that they're making his disgrace an argument against him, that's again Job subverting their arguments, because he keeps telling them they've got nothing on him. They've got nothing to accuse him of. All they have is what he's going through right now. They can look and they can say, well, you're suffering, therefore you must have done something really bad. What? Well, I just keep suffering and saying these things, so I know you did it. You need to repent. What did I do? And Job's keep coming back to him like, you got nothing on me. You can't accuse me of anything. You can't say that I deserve this for any reason. And this is really present in this idea where he's saying, you're making my disgrace an argument against me. You're looking at my disgrace, and that's the substance of your argument. Not a real point, not a real substantive thing you can look at and say, that's why you need to change. And then in verse 6, when he says, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me, I think that now he's going to use himself as an example of a warning to them. And he's saying that, look what God has done to me. I mean, if he did this to me, do you think you're going to escape from what you're doing right now? You think there won't be accountability for you? Look what he's done to me. I mean, you're using these lies to torment an already tormented person. You think you're going to escape from that? So let's just keep doing what you're doing and we'll see how that goes for you. So then in verses 7 through 12, I think that it's along those lines that he's offering this up. He's trying to use himself as an example of why they should stop. Because look at all the bad things that are happening to him. In verse 7 it says, "Behold, I cry out violence, but I am not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness upon my paths. He has stripped me from my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone, and my hope he has pulled up like a tree. He has kindled his wrath against me and counts me as his adversary. His troops come on together. They have cast up their siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent." So now in verse 13, Job's going to start bringing it back around to them and the judgment that will be waiting for them. In verse 13, he says, "He has put my brothers far from me, and those who knew me are wholly estranged from me. My relatives have failed me. My close friends have forgotten me. The guests in my house and my maidservants count me as a stranger. I have become a foreigner in their eyes. I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer. I must plead with him with my mouth for mercy," his own servant. "My breath is strange to my wife, and I am a stench to the children of my own mother. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. All my intimate friends abhor me, and those whom I love have turned against me." My bones stick to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh? So I don't have to get into a lot of detail when he goes through all the troubles that have happened with his relationships and all the various relationships he goes through. But just suffice it to say that when friends and loved ones fail us, that really, really stinks when that happens. And I don't know that I need to say more than that. That's really, really crummy. We already looked at verse 22. In verse 21, Job is pleading for his friends to just show him mercy so he can feel some comfort. And now we get back to this idea of returning to accountability and vindication in the remainder of the chapter. In verse 23, he says, "Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book." Kind of irony, right? "Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, 'How we will pursue him, and the root of the matter is found in him,' be afraid of the sword, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment." So just a few observations here. In contrast to the comments of his friends about how the wicked have no root and how Bildad just said they won't be remembered, their name won't be in the street, Job is saying, like, no, this needs to be remembered. This needs to be written down in a pen of iron. It needs to be inscribed on the rock. And here it is, right? We're reading the book of Job. I mean, here it is. It actually happened in a very literal way. When we read this book and when we have these classes, we are, in a sense, Job's vindication. It's kind of interesting to think about that. So, you know, even though Job, I don't think, handled everything perfectly, God did give him that. He gave him that. And the verse 25, when he says, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth." That sounds like a great statement of faith, but I don't think it really is intended to be that. I think that the idea of Redeemer here, if you contextualize it, really carries the idea of avenger. He's talking about someone who's going to avenge him. And he's talking about the time in which Job will be vindicated from the accusation of his friends. That's what he's talking about here. I don't think he's speaking of his own salvation and this reconciliation he expects to have with God. I think he thinks at this point in his life, he's going down. Right? It's happened and it's happening. But so are his friends if they don't realize that what they're doing to him is just wrong. I think that's the point behind it. And in verse 26, when he says, "After my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God," this is a tricky verse because it could literally be, "In my flesh I shall see God," or "Not in my flesh I shall see God." So I think the latter makes more sense because Job has just said, "When my skin has thus been destroyed." So unless it's something deeply poetic, like the latter makes more sense to me. And then verses 26 and 27, when 26 we talked about, 27 says, "Whom I shall see for myself, my eyes shall behold and not another. My heart faints within me." Again, I think this is Job painting this scene of him before God and how terrifying it's going to be. But he's expecting them to put themselves in his place. And he's saying, like, just think about how this is going to be and put yourself again in my shoes. Because that's, again, a tactic that he uses throughout this. He's trying to get them to see things from his perspective. And he's saying, "I'm going to stand before him. It's going to be terrifying. Now think about what you're doing right now. Have you not thought about what it's going to be like for you when you stand before him, when you present all these false arguments against me?" So I think it's intended to be this rebuke of his friends, and it's not so much to be read as this like introspection on his part when he thinks about himself. I think he's using it against his friends. So that's Job chapter 19. I'll write up some more comments, kind of some final thoughts about that, but we're out of time for today. And then I'll try to get chapter 20 out to you in the next few days. Thank you, guys.